Good afternoon, everybody. Please be seated. Our final case for today is case number 60194, Hawcrow versus District Court with Pacific Coast Steel as a third-party interest. Leland Eugene Backus is counsel for petitioner. Michael Wall is counsel for real party and interest, and Scott Omohundro as counsel for real party and interest. Mr. Backus.
Thank you very much, Chief Justice. I have with me as co-counsel on this case, Britt Monroe from the Lloyd Gray Whitehead Monroe firm in Birmingham, Alabama.
Welcome to the Nevada Supreme Court.
We currently represent Hawcrow. It's our pleasure to be here today. This matter we're before this court once before in the Rolf Jensen matter, and you allowed us to argue this issue in part in that case. We can now fully address it in this case. We are not seeking on behalf of Hawcrow any blanket exoneration of design professionals. We're not seeking that this court eliminate the restatement 552 position. We're not seeking an eradication of negligent misrepresentation claims in this case. We are simply asking this court to follow the wisdom and the policies enunciated in the Terracon decision and follow the application of the economic loss doctrine for design professionals when there are negligence-based claims against that design professional seeking only economic losses. This case is a case that, as the court is aware, started off with PCS, the rebar subcontractor, alleging in a third-party complaint that Hawcrow was negligent in its design, indicating that the design, the structural design for the Harmon Tower at the city center was not constructible, and that we were negligent in our periodic observations that were required to undergo by contract, that we didn't adequately inspect or observe their work and point out to them the wrongdoing of their ways. Judge Gonzalez, upon a motion to dismiss, granted our motion to dismiss, but interestingly allowed PCS additional time to engage in discovery. Under the Rocker decision of this court, we filed a petition for writ of mandamus with this court. You granted that writ, issued the writ, and ordered the lower court judge to vacate that order relative to Rocker. PCS then went to school on this. They revised their pleading to now allege the same factual predicate, but now in terms of negligent misrepresentation, or more particularly under 552 of the restatement. In this case, we have very sophisticated parties. We have MGM, the owner of the property, one of the largest gaming entities in the world, built many structures in Las Vegas and in Washoe County. We have Perini, one of the world's largest general contractors. We have the two rebar contractors, Century Steel and Pacific Coast Steel, PCS, two of the largest rebar contractors in the country. Hawcrow, my client, is an international design firm. These parties are well-equipped to negotiate the risks in their contractual undertakings with one another. The construction industry is, we're all aware, is one that has really been at the forefront of designing comprehensive contracts between design professionals and the contractors and suppliers in a lattice work of risk allocation that is very sophisticated. It is the construction industry that has brought our world the sophisticated knowledge of indemnity, additional insured endorsements, guarantees, warranties, things of that nature, insurance provisions that are well understood in this industry. Parties here have the legal savvy, the financial wherewithal to address all of these risk allocations amongst themselves. The Terracon decision.
Can I ask you a question before you move on?
Justice.
when Justice or Judge Gonzalez allowed the amendment. I'm curious to know how that hearing went. Was there a was it the position that Tara Khan affirmatively gives an indication that we're going to recognize negligent misrepresentation, or was it more in the sense that Nevada ought to, and there's other jurisdictions that do, and we should as well?
Precisely, Judge Gonzalez, who presides over the City Center litigations, as well as many other huge cases in Southern Nevada, specifically noted her concern as to where this court was relative to footnote 10. She specifically referenced that footnote, not knowing what this court's predilection was relative to footnote 10. Footnote 10 was a footnote that basically just addressed the fact that in Callaway, this court, in talking about the economic loss doctrine, had cited the Casa-Cava case, I believe, out of the Florida Supreme Court under the economic loss doctrine. Since that time, the Florida Supreme Court has gone a totally different direction, and this court then cited the Morin-Saas case that eradicated basically the economic loss doctrine for a residential inspection case, and that footnote had some language in it about negligent misrepresentation. I'm not sure that case really was a negligent misrepresentation case, but the footnote addressed that. And thus it appeared at first blush to the reader and to the judge below that possibly this court in the Terracon decision had reserved and for another day the issue of whether negligent misrepresentation would be carved out as an exception to the economic loss doctrine. I don't read the Terracon decision that way that was authored by Justice Gibbons. I read that case in its orderly flow as one where there is a very lengthy discussion of the history and the policies behind the economic loss doctrine, its origination, the Callaway, all the cases in the country. It goes through an analysis of other courts having exceptions, a variety of exceptions, other than just negligent misrepresentation. Others have exceptions for design professionals, for example. And those were all discussed. But at the end analysis, we get to the point where the court unanimously comes to the conclusion that the economic loss doctrine is going to bar not just professional negligence claims, but all negligence-based claims, and goes back to the Stern decision, which was an unintentional tort block by the economic loss doctrine as well. So reading from Stern to Terracon, citing the Colorado Supreme Court case of Dufisi that specifically barred negligent misrepresentation claims of the economic loss doctrine for design professionals, I read that decision as just being a historic explanation of what the economic loss doctrine, in no way, shape, or form was it an approval of negligent misrepresentation as a carve-out or an exception. Judges are reading it differently, though. If I was before Judge Hicks in the federal court, he would agree with me and say, no, negligent misrepresentation is barred by the economic loss doctrine. Judge Paloha in Washoe County, he would agree with me, too. Judge Gonzalez thought otherwise. There's another federal judge in Southern Nevada that believes that there should be a carve-out. So there is a need for clarification of this issue as it is being non-uniformly applied by the trial judges. In this case, though, I think Judge Gonzalez wants the direction of this court. That's why she granted the stay. That's why we have been stayed from the proceedings pending the court's review of this mandamus proceeding. We have cited to the court a plethora of cases. We analyzed the cases on the specific issue of whether negligent misrepresentation should be an exception to the economic loss doctrine involving design professionals. We count 11 states that have agreed with our position. It appears to be the majority of the jurisdictions that disallow that as being an exception. Now that it's election day tomorrow, it looks like most of these states are actually the borderline states for the election, Virginia and Ohio. Some of those are important states, not only for our purposes, but for the election tomorrow.
So does this case, Mr. Backus?
What's up?
So does this case make us a swing state on this subject?
I don't think this will make you a swing state. I think that my reading of the literature and most commentaries on Terracon is it's a lead decision in the country. If you read the commentaries of the law review articles, Terracon is usually one of the first cited cases in the country, and we should be proud of that fact, and we should be proud of the extension of it. The policies that underline this are lengthy. I know Chief Justice Cherry in the recent Fountainbleau decision referenced back to one policy that I think we should be foremost on our minds, and that is, not only that case has no relevance to this case, it was an equitable subrogation case, but there was a historic reference to Senate Bill 206 in that decision, the legislative history of our construction industry was noted in legislative history as being one of the worst places to do business in the United States.
I can't let you sit down in this first part without getting some comment from you as to Built Right versus Architectural Studio.
I'd be happy to. That decision out of the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, Your Honor, has certainly gone a different direction than this court. Two points I would like to make about that decision by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. I'd first invite your reading by the Chief Justice's dissent in that case, which was a riveting attack on the majority, and I think more consistent with this court's opinion in Terracon. But secondly, if we look at the aftermath of Built Right, I think that is very important, Justice Douglas, because there are cases out of Pennsylvania that have followed that permissive viewpoint of the Built Right decision that have opened proverbially Pandora's box. There are now all kinds of cases that are now being permitted to be filed and adjudicated in Pennsylvania that I believe Tishman addressed in its brief to this court in its amicus brief. The problem, personally, I have with this argument is classically demonstrated by PCS in this case. When you take any negligence claim, any professional name, I don't care if it's negligent design and a mistake in plans, an error in specifications, an observation report that wasn't done right, a geotechnical engineer that's supposed to do a boring log, and you say you're negligent in doing that, and then this court says, no, you can't pursue economic losses for negligence, so you must then reconstitute that, restate it in a negligent misrepresentation claim, and you can do that in every single solitary case. The exception to the rule, as we say, would swallow the rule. It would eviscerate the rule by adopting it. I'd like to reserve my remaining time if there are no questions.
Certainly. Mr. Wall, on behalf of BCS.
Thank you, Your Honor. Michael Wall for Century Steel. I have with me Scott Amahandro for Pacific Coast Steel, and I'm going to attempt to leave a couple of minutes, two or three minutes, for him to address some issues at the end. Your Honor, first and foremost, this case is being dragged on partly because this court is entertaining eight petitions for writs. And I understand this court that this is an important issue and the court wants to address an important issue, but I think that you need to be careful about when this court decides to second-guess the district court, when the district court has done nothing except allow an amendment to a pleading. It's a little bit too early when they haven't even brought a motion to dismiss it for summary judgment for this court to be interfering in the handling of the case and slowing it down. But most importantly, we only have one real issue to talk about today. The sole defense that Halcro has or has raised in this petition to the claims that have been that we're attempting to bring in district court is that the economic loss doctrine absolutely is a bar to the action. And we heard it from Mr. Backus, and it's stated multiple times in their pleadings They think that Terracon has already decided this issue, and we believe that Terracon has not decided this issue. We think it's an important policy issue that's still open for the court. It says in their reply that they simply seek this court's reaffirmance of its holding in Terracon that in Nevada, all negligence-based claims against design professionals are barred by the economic loss doctrine. The word all in that sentence is bold and underlined. It's not in the quotation within the quotation marks because it's not the language of this court. And that's what they have been trying to push upon this court on the economic loss doctrine, is that Terracon was that broad and it wasn't that broad. Two things in Terracon tell me that it wasn't that broad. One of them was that this court specifically recognized in Terracon that there are exceptions to the economic loss doctrine. This court stated that exceptions to the economic loss doctrine exist in broad categories of cases in which the policy concerns about administrative costs and a disproportionate balance between liability and fault are insignificant, or other countervailing considerations weigh in favor of liability. In that very statement, this court noted one of those broad exceptions as negligent misrepresentation. The situation that we have here is negligent misrepresentation. I think this is where the petitioners are wrong.
Mr. Wall, couldn't that be argued that that was in the context of like financial frauds or something, or accounting firm securities issues where you're not in privity of contract with the lawyers or the securities firm, but people, investors suffer financial harm, Bernie Madoff, stuff like that. Could that be argued that way as opposed to in the construction industry when you're dealing with design professionals?
What we have is a structural engineer. Exactly. If the economic loss doctrine is not so broad, and obviously there are places where it's easy to say economic loss doctrine shouldn't apply. In fact, this court has said it doesn't apply in the case of a fraud-based claim. That's where the petitioners are wrong. They say that Terracon applies to all negligence-based claims. And then they insist, without any authority whatsoever, that negligent misrepresentation is a negligence-based claim. Negligent misrepresentation is not a negligence-based claim in Nevada. It's a fraud-based claim in Nevada, as near as we can tell from the case law. Now, I admit this is an area of law that hasn't been addressed, but there's a split of authority, not just in the economic loss doctrine area, but in the area of pleading, whether you have to plead it with a negligent misrepresentation claim with particularity. In the area of statute of limitations, do we apply a fraud statute of limitation or do we apply a negligent statute of limitation? And many states say negligent misrepresentation is a claim of deceit. It's a fraud. It's fraud-based, and they apply a fraud-based statute of limitation and fraud-based pleading. Other states say, no, it's a negligence claim, and they apply a negligence statute of limitation. And this court hasn't directly decided that. But the Barr-Mettler course case seems to say it's a fraud-based claim in Nevada because it's defined in terms of fraud. So they say all negligence-based claims are barred, but that's just begging the question. The question here is, what is the policy reason for not barring a fraud claim under the economic loss doctrine, but at the same time barring a negligence claim under the economic loss doctrine? And originally a general negligence claim was brought, but that was dismissed and we haven't challenged that. The claim that's brought now is negligent misrepresentation. They intended us to rely specifically on their representation. So they talked about the realities of the business world, in the contract world, and they said all of these contracts that are drafted up, but this is the reality of the contract world for the subcontractor. It's not like they can go out there and take a different contract. The contract, they're three contracts removed from the structural engineer. The sole purpose of the structural engineer is to make representations upon which they are required to rely. They have to do it the way the structural engineer tells them to do it. And when the structural engineer tells them, you can adjust this after the fact, and when the structural engineer makes representations to them that on-site adjustments can be made, that that they are doing inspections, that they have done inspections, and the inspections have been correct. We don't have a choice except to rely. And the concept, the policy behind the economic loss doctrine is that you can go out there if you know what the contracts are, and you can get insurance, and that's how we deal with the risks of liability and the floodgate issue that they had. You can't go out there and get insurance against fraud, not at any price that would allow you to be able to stay in business. You can't reject as a subcontractor the contracts that have been written for the purpose of protecting everybody along that line. And they work well when you're talking about protecting people for professional negligence, which economic loss doctrine applies to, for the work that is done by the contractor or by any of the other subs. All of those issues are dealt with well in contract, but one issue isn't dealt with well in contract, and that's fraud. And negligent misrepresentation is a type of fraud. In this case, it's the worst type of fraud because they told us, crank the rebar, make it fit. Our plans don't work. The horizontal doesn't match, but that's all right. We have to pour, and we're pouring tomorrow at such and such an hour, and you've got to be ready to go and crank it. We were told to do that. That's a negligent misrepresentation. The other thing that we were told is we have inspected it, and it's done right, and it's okay. They either, and these representations at this point have to be taken as true. They either did not do the inspections at all, or they misrepresented what they saw in those inspections, and we relied on that. We relied on it on the first floor. We relied on it on the second floor. And more until we're 18 stories up in the sky, and we're being told, you're responsible for our plans that are bad and for following our representations, and the building has to come down. Now we have the general contractor, Perini, suing us because we didn't do the rebar right, and we did that in reliance upon the structural engineer. Economic loss doctrine was simply not intended to apply in this situation. And Terracon recognizes that that's not an issue that's being decided. Terracon has a footnote that says, we disagree with this Florida case, but oh, by the way, the Florida case was dealing with negligent misrepresentation, so that may be different. So Terracon has left that question open. We don't believe that it's decided at that point.
What about now, Mr. Backus's claim that every negligence case could be made into a negligent misrepresentation case, and then there goes the economic loss doctrine?
Every lawyer can make a two-word sentence ambiguous. Every lawyer can plead the way that they need to plead. And that's always going to be the issue of, well, we don't allow you to plead it in the first place because a clever lawyer could plead it that way. If they don't plead it that way, that's what the district courts are for, and they're the gatekeeper. That's where the gatekeeper function is. And counsel said, Mr. Backus said, that if you look at that Built Right case, which, by the way, looked at all of the cases and determined that there isn't really a clear majority and that the trend is toward the direction that we would like you to go, which is that negligent misrepresentation is a fraud. There's only five cases that have been brought. It hasn't been a floodgates that were projected. And all five of those cases didn't get to a jury. They got dismissed out by district courts along the way. The floodgates simply just don't exist. If I can, I'd like to reserve the rest of the time, Your Honors, to my co-counsel.
Sure, certainly.
Scott Omohundro on behalf of Pacific Coast Steel. Thank you for this opportunity. I'd just like to make a couple points in this short time. The economic loss doctrine is not an immunity doctrine. It's not a get-out-of-jail-free card. The purpose of the economic loss doctrine is to prevent liability out of proportion to fault, and we do not have that here because we're talking about negligent misrepresentation as defined by Restatement Section 552. 552 specifically and expressly limits the scope of liability to a defined class of plaintiffs, to the intended recipients of that false information, so there can be no surprises. As Mr. Wall mentioned, the Supreme Courts have looked at this issue, have determined there is no clear majority, but the modern trend is to allow negligent misrepresentation claims against design professionals.
What constitutes the modern trend?
Well, if you take a look at the Built Right case, Pennsylvania, they discuss
one.
Sure.
One doesn't make a trend.
No, I understand. And these are statements made by the Supreme Court. There's also the Guardian case in the Delaware Supreme Court, the Jim's Excavation in Montana, John Martin in Tennessee, and Biley in California. And they've looked at the cases and determined on their own that there is not a clear majority, but a modern trend, which actually looks at 552 and the fact that it reflects the modern realities of business. It recognizes it's reasonable to hold professionals accountable for providing false information. And thirdly, it avoids exonerating professionals. And it's important to understand, how does it do that? How does 550 do that? It does that by the safeguards that are built into it. It limits liability. First of all, it's an objective standard. It looks to the specific circumstances. It limits liability to when a party supplies false information it knows will be relied upon, and it limits liability to situations when a party supplying the information is able to assess the risk going forward. And an important point I want to make, in the Guardian case, the Delaware Supreme Court looks at the two lines of cases that address negligent misrepresentation. The first line, liability is based on foreseeable reliance. And the controlling question there is, was it foreseeable to the negligent supplier of information that the injured party would rely upon that information?
Now, counsel, you're not arguing that Halcro intentionally supplied false information. You're just saying they did it negligently.
That's correct.
Okay.
With the intent that that false information would be relied upon either a specific third party or a class of identifiable third parties. In this case, the reinforcing steel subcontractors. So that's the intent part of it. But no, this is not an intentional misrepresentation claim. But they 352 in the second line of cases is reflected in liabilities based on intended reliance. And that's set forth in Justice Cardozo's analysis in the Glanzer case, and it's reflected in the provisions of 552. It takes foreseeability a step further, and it requires the false information be intended by its negligent supplier to be specifically relied upon by a particular party or class of parties. And that's what we have with 552. I submit that Halcro is offering a false choice. This is not a choice between unlimited liability and no liability, because we have Section 552.
But when you're talking about foreseeability, isn't that something specifically this court was concerned about in Stern, and the foreseeability as it relates to unlimited liability?
Well, I appreciate that, but I think that's where you take the second step in terms of 552, and you base it on intended reliance. And intended reliance limits it. There's really only two parties here who have a negligent misrepresentation claim against Halcro. It would be the steel subcontractors, Century Steel and Pacifico Steel. So I think in terms of unlimited liability, that is not a concern in connection with 552. Because 552 also applies a uniform standard. It does not allow for a blanket exoneration, which is what we would have here if the court ruled in favor of Halcro. There's simply no logical reason to create an exception for a structural engineer, design professional. Because what do they have in common with other professionals? They provide information for the guidance of others. And it's even more important that we do not create an exception for structural engineers based on the significance and importance of what they do supply, information relating to the structural stability that will lead to the structural stability of the building. In conclusion, I think the better policy and the modern trend, I believe, is to apply an objective and uniform standard that limits liability to a defined class of plaintiffs without exonerating specific professions, and it serves the public interest in discouraging this sort of behavior. There's no concern for unlimited liability if we follow the intended reliance line of cases that it's set forth in 552. It's not an issue of duty. It's an issue of allowing liability. It's not a question of no liability versus unliability. We have a bright line. It's 552. We would ask that.
Go ahead and finish your thought.
I'm sorry?
You can go ahead.
We would ask that, as Mr. Wall said, that the district courts be the gatekeepers and apply Section 552 in Pennsylvania. As you mentioned, the five cases were all decided prior to trial in favor of the design professionals, and we believe on the basis of either a motion to dismiss or an MSJ. So there certainly is not a danger of opening the floodgates. Thank you
very much. Mr. Backus, your rebuttal in this matter?
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Last comment first about foreseeability. In addition to Stern, in Terracon, Justice Gibbons also, I read that decision as rejecting the foreseeability requirement and making the policy determination that the line of demarcation was going to be between contract law and predictability of result and reasonable calculable risks versus tort law. Relative to the cases, the trend decision in the brief, it was a number of counts in the courts. Now it's a trend, I guess. But those cases are clearly to be differentiated. The five jurisdictions that they did cite that were negligent misrepresentation cases that dealt with design professionals, two of those were bid cases that might arguably go to a 552 business transaction kind of an argument. That is not this case. This is not a bid case at all. One was a direct supervisor case. One came from Kentucky that has never adopted the economic loss doctrine. The other cases did not deal with design professionals at all, so hardly that is a trend. As to too many petitions in the Halcro case before this court has granted those petitions and issued writs of mandamus that should speak volumes as to the propriety of mandamus in this particular case. Other countervailing considerations, there is no need for special tort protection for the sophisticated parties in this case. They don't need it. They have the wherewithal financially, legally, to adjudicate and allocate their own risks. And we ought to leave it to contract law. If they have a claim against Perini, they can follow that contract chain. If Perini wants to sue MGM, Perini can go against MGM. If MGM wants to go against the architect, they can go against the architect. If the architect wants to sue my client, the structural engineer, they have a contract remedy there. They've allocated those risks. That's where this case should be. As far as the 552 claims not being negligent-based, being fraud-based, I invite your reading to comment A of the Restatement Second on Torts. It says the liability under 552 is a negligence-based claim. Of course it is. It is not intentional fraud. It is not intentional misrepresentation or deceit. It is not the fraud standard. It is misrepresentation, but on a negligence-based predicate. I think the Wyoming court is worth looking at, the Ristler decision.
Go ahead and finish your talk, Mr. Parks.
That we shouldn't utilize negligent misrepresentation to get around the contractual situation these parties find themselves in. Thank you,
Chief. Can I ask one more question?
Absolutely.
Mr. Backus, unrelated to the merits of the economic loss rule, I'm concerned about one other issue. Perhaps you could address Mr. Wall brought it up. If we had an opinion in this case, the factual predicate is that it's a denial or granting of a motion for leave to amend. Now, our case law says that the court has vast discretion to do that, the district courts, and leave to amend. It's not a grant or denial of summary judgment. How would we do an opinion that doesn't do violence to that case law if we were going to grant a writ here on a motion to amend? That's my concern.
In this particular case, Justice Gibbons, we sought this petition before this court upon the court's granting leave to amend, and Justice Gonzalez stayed this matter pending your decision. We have cited to the court the futility law cases that say the court, in looking under Rule 15 at a motion to amend, should not grant a motion to amend when the claim is futile. That has been our position since day one. There is no claim. It seems to me to be form over substance to put the cart behind the horse with doing the motion to dismiss later on or motion for summary judgment later on this exact issue. This is a legal issue. It's not a factual issue. There's nothing to dispute factually here. We admitted the facts that are in the pleading. We take those as being true. And so the matter of timing should not be the impediment to this court's decision. It is still a question of law. The court should have denied the, particularly in the history of this case, where we'd already had one motion to dismiss on the negligence claims that was granted, and now we reconstitute those as negligent misrepresentation 552 claims. The court knew exactly where we were. We briefed it fully on the motion seeking leave to amend. It was a full legal blown argument. It took some significant time to argue before Judge Gonzalez. She appreciated that. She granted them leave to amend, but then granted our stay so we could be here today.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel. Having seen you argue before, I expected fine argument, at least to this Chief Justice's opinion. The argument was excellent. The briefs were excellent. This case will stand submitted, and we are in recess until tomorrow at 10 o'clock. Thank you very much, counsel.